Welcome to The Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. In this episode, we talk with Robert Hartman about the problems of free will and moral luck and how they're related to one another.
Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Robert Hartman, who's currently a visiting assistant professor of philosophy at Tulane University. Bob has published many articles on issues related to free will and moral responsibility, and he's written a book on moral luck called In Defense of Moral Luck, Why Luck Often Affects Praiseworthiness and Blameworthiness, which was published by Routledge in 2017. He's recently written a chapter on free will and moral luck for the new Wiley-Blackwell Companion to Free Will, which is still in press. And we thought we'd ask Bob to give us a preview and to explain how the problems of free will and moral luck are related to each other. So welcome to the show, Bob. Thanks for joining us. Can you start by telling us and our audience a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on free will?
Yes. First off, thank you both for inviting me to be on your podcast. It's an honor to be here. Okay.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, for sure.
So something about me. I was a religious studies major when I got to college, because my first love in academia was theology. And in taking courses in religious studies, I just wasn't impressed by the prevailing norms in the classroom. It was more like religious anthropology and religious history. But I wanted to know whether various religions were true or false. And these kinds of questions were not encouraged in the program. So I stumbled into a philosophy classroom, and there I found my people, as it were. People who were asking the questions that I cared about. And because I was interested in theology, I naturally gravitated to thinking about philosophy of religion. I was vexed by the problem of evil, and I thought I wanted to examine, you know, the role of free will and whether free will provides a plausible response, and if it doesn't on its own, to what extent does it provide a good response to the problem of evil? And that leads into other questions about, well, do we have free will?
Yeah.
And so that's a little bit about me and how I first got excited thinking about free will.
Before we get started in talking about how moral luck and free will are related, can you just give us a reminder about what moral luck is? So if listeners want to, they can go back and listen to the very first season when we talked to Dan and Elkin. But until they have a chance to do that, let's just give a quick gloss.
Yeah, very simply, the problem of moral luck is that luck, on the one hand, is ubiquitous. It affects what consequences result from our actions. So in the case of two people who both go to the party and drive home recklessly, where one person, we could call this person Killer, when Killer swerves and hits a curb, he kills a pedestrian. Whereas Merely Reckless is exactly in every way like Killer, except that there's nobody on the curb for Merely Reckless to kill. And so Merely Reckless gets home safely. And there's also luck in our circumstances. So we can imagine a third person, No Start, who is exactly like Killer and Merely Reckless, who's at the party, decides to drive home recklessly. But when No Start turns the key, the car doesn't start, not able to get home that way. He's got to call a cab. He's been saved by good luck. And then lastly, luck in our mental dispositions and in our constitution. A fourth character, we'll call this person Scarred Childhood. In the past, Scarred Child, when they were a youth, their father died at the hand of a drunk driver. And as a result, they formed this aversion through no effort of their free will toward drunk driving and toward reckless driving. And so when they go to the party and have a drink, it's unthinkable that this person would get behind the wheel. Okay. So that's, on the one hand, luck is everywhere. It pervades the consequences of our action, the circumstances in which we find ourselves, and our mental dispositions, mental tendencies. But on the other hand, there's a common sense principle that's part of our inherited conception of morality, that we're morally responsible only for what's within our control. And so if we factor out the luck from all these cases, it looks like there's nothing left. We're stuck with what Nagel calls an extensionless point. There's no free agency left. It's all been factored out. And so that briefly is the puzzle of moral luck. How can we affirm the control principle while avoiding the skeptical conclusion? And that's a puzzle that a lot of philosophers have, they work on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So philosophers work on this problem. They also work on the problem of free will, but often those problems get treated in isolation from each other. So could you say a little bit about how these two literatures, the problem of moral luck and the problem of free will, intersect with each other?
Absolutely. Very briefly, I think they intersect in two really interesting ways. First, both literatures are concerned about whether people have the right kind of control over their actions to be free and responsible with respect to those actions. So one way to read the free will literature is to think about it in terms of what kinds of capacities or dispositions or a real self do I have to have in order to act freely, because those capacities or dispositions or even the real self is granting them a kind of control over their actions such that it makes sense, at least potentially, to hold them responsible for them. Okay. And the moral luck literature, as we've just highlighted, considers whether and the extent to which people can be morally responsible for actions and consequences that are ubiquitously affected by luck. So that's the first point. The second point is that both literatures, the free will literature and the moral luck literature, are both very concerned about constitutive luck. This is a kind of luck in our mental dispositions that guides what reasons occur to us and the weights at which those reasons occur to us, whether they strike us as good reasons. And because we're not self-made selves, because we don't create ourselves from nothing, both of these literatures have considered the fact that we can't eliminate constitutive luck to pose a big problem for our self-conception as free and responsible agents.
Nice. What are some ways that these two problems are different from each other?
Okay, good. This is going to be a little bit more contentious. So my old colleague from the Lund-Gothenburg Responsibility Project, Kristen Mickelson, would say that they're not really different. They're just different rhetorical frameworks aimed at getting at the same problem. And I think she's right. If you think, for example, that the fact that we are not self-made selves rules out our being morally responsible. So if you think that the correct answer to the problem of moral luck is that not only are we not responsible, we're just not the kind of beings that can be responsible, then, well, you're going to get the same kind of answer in the free will literature. And so if this is how you're thinking about the problem, I think she's right to say that they're just different heuristical frameworks or rhetorical frameworks for getting at the same problem. Mm-hmm. But I myself think that my previous colleague and free will skeptics in general, at least free will skeptics from luck, are incorrect. So here are some big differences that I see between these literatures. First, causation plays an importantly different role in these literatures. So skeptical arguments from free will usually appeal to some causal premise about human action, that it's causally determined by factors outside of our control, or that there's some kind of indeterministic causation, which gives rise to questions about whether the agent is doing the acting or whether the agent has disappeared, what have you. So that's on the free will side, but skeptical arguments from moral luck don't appeal to any kind of contentious premise about whether our actions are causally determined or indeterministic. It's rather from the kinds of luck that constitutive luck, that is luck in our mental dispositions, or circumstantial luck, luck in our circumstances, kinds of luck that are just obviously beset human beings. So that's one important difference between these literatures in terms of the premises in their skeptical arguments. Another important difference between these literatures is, I think, is about the objects of moral responsibility. The free will literature focuses more on actions, even in some cases just mental actions, not overt bodily actions. Whereas the moral luck literature, at least as a matter of emphasis, focuses on moral responsibility for consequences. Especially highlighted by the drunk driver case that we began with, about how killer and merely the only difference between them is how their action turns out. And that's the kind of case that has really animated the moral luck debate from the beginning. So those are, I think, two of the main differences, at least as a matter of emphasis, between the moral luck and free will literatures.
Nice. Well, we've talked about luck several times on the podcast before, and Greg Caruso appealed to luck in support of his free will skepticism in our second season, where we talked about positions and the debate about free will and determinism. But could you summarize one or two challenges to moral responsibility that are based on luck?
Sure. I'll summarize two. The two skeptical arguments from luck that I think are getting the most traction and indeed deserve the most traction. Okay, so here's the first one. It's the one highlighted by Galen Strawson and his basic argument for the impossibility of moral responsibility. So Strawson has different formulations of the argument. I'm just going to highlight a simple one, but the criticisms that I'll offer also apply to the more developed versions of the argument. So here's the first premise. A person is morally responsible for an action only if they've made themselves from nothing, only if they're a causa sui. Why think that? Well, says Strawson, what you do is a function of who you are. So, in order to have control over what you do, you've got to have control over who you are. And the kind of control that you've got to have over who you are in order to be ultimately responsible for what you do is to have this creation ex nihilo past, where you have brought yourself into existence with your constitutive makeup. Okay, so that's the first premise and its justification. The next premise is it's impossible for us to do that. Indeed, it's impossible even for God. So it's impossible to be responsible for anything. And instead of highlighting the next argument, I think maybe I'll just say a few things, some of my criticisms of this argument first. Yeah, so we won't have to hold too many things in our head.
Yeah. I have a hard time sometimes holding things in my head.
Good. So first, I think that the first premise that in order to be responsible for what you do, you have to have created yourself from nothing, it's just far too demanding And this is a criticism that I've made a whole lot of philosophers have made. So my voice, in metaphorical terms, is joining a chorus here. we just don't need to make ourselves from nothing in order to be responsible for what we do. Okay.
Can I ask a quick question to butt in here? You didn't mention what kind of responsibility Strawson is talking about. So is his stringent requirement because he's got a view of responsibility that most people don't have?
Good question. I think the answer is no. Okay. I think Strawson usually does talk about, or often talks about, heaven and hell responsibility.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
But I think that this is a rhetorical flourish. He's not actually interested in the kind of responsibility you'd need to deserve some kind of eternal torment or eternal bliss. Rather, he's talking about what Dirk Paraboom highlights as basic desert moral responsibility. That to be responsible for something in this backward-looking sense is just... you're responsible for it. You're liable to certain kinds of blame or praise just because you've done it, regardless of forward-looking considerations. And if you're interested in some Strawson exegesis, where I think Strawson can be compellingly interpreted as making that more modest mainstream claim about the nature of moral responsibility, I can point you to one of my papers where I do that.
Cool. Yeah.
I was gonna plug one of your papers on this. So you have the paper in the Journal of the American Philosophical Association. Maybe that's the one you had in mind, on Strawson and constitutive luck. And it's an excellent paper. So listeners who are interested in this should definitely check that out.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes for sure.
Cool. Yeah, that's the paper I was thinking.
Okay, good.
Okay, so the second criticism about that self-creation requirement in order to be morally responsible for what we do is just that not all constitutive luck, not all luck in our mental dispositions, what reasons occur to us, mitigates or undermines responsibility. I think some kinds of constitutive luck quite clearly enable us to be morally responsible agents. And so in this way, we're lucky. For anybody who has free will, they're lucky to have it. And other kinds of constitutive luck are banal. They neither enable and they don't undermine freedom either. So I think that Strawson is making a mistake in thinking that all just any kind of constitutive luck totally undermines moral responsibility. But I'll end this little segment on Strawson by highlighting something I agree with in Strawson. And I think it's that constitutive luck, when we're acting from a purely constitutively lucky disposition or set of dispositions, that can mitigate or decrease our degree of moral responsibility, especially in comparison with an average adult who has formed their character through previous free actions and so has kind of built up some responsibility for who they are, which I think can get transferred to their actions as they go along. So I think that this is what I take to be a kernel of insight from Galen Strawson's basic argument that when we act from a purely constitutively lucky mental dispositions, that can decrease our moral responsibility. Yeah. It provides a partial, not a full excuse, a partial excuse. And I know that Taylor has argued along these lines as well in his paper on manipulation and constitutive luck.
Nice. Well, that's one that's one worry about luck for moral responsibility, Galen Strawson's basic argument. You said you might summarize two. Do you want to go through another one?
Let's do one more. Sure. Let's do it. So this one is Neil Levy's luck pincer. And this is an argument that was defended by Greg Caruso as well on the podcast earlier. Here's a simplified version of Levy's argument. First, every action for which we might be morally responsible is either constitutively lucky or it's circumstantially lucky. And here's the justification for that. An action is saliently explained either by your character, for example, when your character significantly privileges one course of action over the others. If you choose in accordance with that, it's explained by your character. But there are other cases where you're torn, and your character doesn't tell you to go one way or another. And in those kinds of cases, chancy circumstantial features near the moment of choice, what Al Mealy calls present luck, can saliently explain why you go one way rather than another. Or there's a third option where your character has been refined by previous circumstantially lucky actions. So they're kind of compounded together. So then Levy's first premise, then just recall, is that every action for which we might be morally responsible is either constitutively lucky, circumstantially lucky, or both. So that's the first premise. The second premise is just that luck, circumstantial luck, constitutive luck, undermines moral responsibility. And here's Levy's argument for this premise. It's a little bit deep into the weeds. We've got to go in order to see the justification for it. But basically, it's a dialectical consideration. Levy is trying to convince a family of compatibilist groups who think that there is some historical condition on moral responsibility that we don't have free will. And those views think that they agree that constitutive luck is a problem and it's got to be overcome in some way. Whether it's the Fisher and Revisa taking responsibility view, or the condition that Levy himself offers, Levy construes of these historical conditions in large part as trying to overcome the problem of constitutive luck. But here's why luck undermines responsibility. It's just that you can't undo constitutive luck with more luck. Because as we saw in the previous premise, right, all the actions by which you might take responsibility for who you are either constitutively lucky or circumstantially lucky, or both. And so luck is inescapable. It can't be undone. And so, we'll conclude Levy's argument. We can't be morally responsible for our actions. Okay. So here I'm going to just offer two really brief responses. The first one is that, well, I should back up. In my book, I argued that luck does not undermine the relevant control in order to be morally responsible for an action. And what's a bit surprising, or it was surprising to me, not surprising to Neil, I'm sure, is that Neil agreed with me on that score. That is, Levy agrees that luck does not undermine control. However, he thinks that luck undermines free will directly. Not because it undermines control. So he's got kind of just an intuition here that luck undermines responsibility. Okay. So here are my two brief responses. First, Levy and others just define free will as the control condition on moral responsibility. And so if luck does not undermine control, it's not going to undermine free will. Okay. Here's a second one. Here's a second really quick response. And that's we should reject the starting assumption, the dialectical assumption that Levy exploits in the luck pincer. Mm-hmm. And the assumption is that in order to be responsible for what you do, you got to be responsible. You need to have taken responsibility for who you are. And if you deny the proponent of the luck pincer, that dialectical assumption, and say that indeed we can act freely and responsibly, at least to some degree, even when I'm not responsible to any extent for who I am, then Levy's going to have to come up with a new new argument to defend the luck undermines responsibility premise. And I myself am not sanguine that any argument is going to be forthcoming because, I guess my intuitions go a very different direction than Levy on this score.
Yeah. In previous seasons of the podcast, we've talked about various non-skeptical positions in the debate about free will and determinism, including some varieties of libertarianism and also different types of compatibilism. What important connections do you see between work on moral luck on the one hand and these positions in the free will debate on the other hand?
Okay, cool. Let's start off with the compatibilist research program. So I think that being a compatibilist kind of primes the way to accept or to allow certain kinds of luck and circumstance and luck in constitution to positively affect how much praise or blame a person deserves. So I think that being a compatibilist creates a kind of presumption in favor of accepting these kinds of moral luck. Because if you think that my actions having been causally determined by factors outside of my control doesn't yield an excuse of force, doesn't itself rule out my being free or responsible with respect to that action. And the force, the excuse of force in any case, is much stronger in the case of causal determination, which guarantees that I'll perform a particular action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But notice that the force of circumstantial luck and constitutive luck are not as great. And so if the force of the greater doesn't excuse, the force of the lesser isn't going to excuse either. Something like that. I think right. that there's an interesting connection there in providing a compatibilist presumption in favor of accepting these kinds of moral luck. Even though some philosophers, of course, have denied this. I've already mentioned Neil Levy. He's a compatibilist, and of course, he thinks that causal determinism okay, doesn't undermine freedom, but that these other kinds of luck do. So it's not uncontentious, and Levy has an interesting reply. But I will say that mainstream compatibilists, in any case, do accept a lot of constitutive and circumstantial moral luck. And I'll just mention two views. So real self views say that people are praiseworthy for good features of their character and for bad features of their character just because they have them. And those features of character are, say, responsive to their judgments, something like that. That's a view from Angela Smith. On this view, it doesn't matter how they got that character, it could have come from neuroscientists. It could have come from indoctrination. It could have come from, you know, broader culture. And just because they have those dispositions, they're praiseworthy or blameworthy for them. And just because they act on those dispositions, they're praiseworthy and blameworthy for those actions. So this is a view that's going to accept a lot of constitutive moral luck, because their mental dispositions formed in ways totally outside of their control becomes a sufficient basis for moral appraisal, in particular with respect to their deserving praise and blame. But other compatibilist views are going to accept way less constitutive moral luck because, like reason's responsiveness views, because they think that people are praiseworthy for their character traits only insofar as those traits have been shaped by their free actions. And probably not just shaped by their free actions. It's got to be done in a way that was reasonably foreseeable. And so that's going to greatly circumscribe how character traits can be evaluated in terms of their deserving praise and blame.
Yeah. All right, so that's the compatibilists. What about the libertarians?
Yeah, I think the libertarian has some really, really interesting connections. So yeah, let's do it. Incompatibilism, you'll recall, is just the view that luck in causal determination rules out or precludes our acting freely. At least that's one construal of the incompatibilist relation. And I think that incompatibilists can be motivated to affirm incompatibilism in two different ways that interact with the moral luck debate. So here's the first. First, they got to say causal luck, or my actions being causally determined by factors outside of my control, that's pernicious to my freedom because all luck is pernicious to freedom. And recall that this is the exact kind of reasoning that the skeptics are giving. Mm-hmm. And so for these libertarians, to avoid skepticism, they tend to embrace what we might say as extravagant metaphysical considerations. So here are two such views. One such view is the Kantian view, that we're postulating a noumenal realm outside space and time, where my free agency really lies. And there, my free agency totally floats free of constitutive luck and circumstantial luck. Okay, so that's one way to think about. That's one version of libertarianism, that incompatibilism that's motivated by the idea we've got to factor out all luck. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to see how, I mean, my criticism of this view is it's just really hard to see how you can act for reasons on this kind of view, because our reasons are furnished by our lucky circumstances. Our reasons are furnished by our mental dispositions that are outside of our control. And insofar as it's a realm that's postulated where we're acting from reasons totally divorced from those kinds of influences, it looks like a kind of free agency that, well, it's hard to see how it's a rational free agency, how it's free agency based on reasons. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's not a real popular view. Here's a more popular view. This is a view that Michael Zimmerman and David Enoch and others have embraced, what Nathan Hanna calls the counterfactual gambit. On this view, consequences do not influence how much praise and blame we deserve. And the actual world is very limiting right? Because that's just a few of the possible ways that I could have been and I could have acted. So if we're going to have a totally luck-free view, I got to not only be morally responsible for what I actually do, but I've got to be morally responsible for what I would have done in non-actual circumstances and with non-actual constitutive makeups. So what I would have done if I was a very different person than I happen to be by the contingencies of fortune, and what I would have done if, you know, that I got that big break elsewhere, or I was denied that big break. Okay. And so this view looks like it's giving us everything we want, because on the one hand, it's luck-free in important respect. And on the other hand, it doesn't collapse into skepticism. But in order to avoid that, it's becomes a bit extravagant because it's explosive. Instead of being responsible for nothing, we're responsible for a lot. to keep the metaphorical symmetry, it would be responsible for everything. And this view, there are a lot of drawbacks to this view, I think, which make it unattractive. For one, it's not clear that there's, if libertarianism is true, it's not clear that there's anything that I would have done in counterfactual or non-actual circumstances and with non-actual constitutive properties. And here's a brief reason for thinking that's true. Truths or true propositions supervene on being or are grounded in actuality. But there's nothing to ground the truth of these claims about what I would have freely done in non-actual circumstances. Just by the nature of the libertarian claim that I have alternative possibilities at the moment of choice. My actual volitions aren't sufficient to ground the truth of these counterfactuals, because if I do act freely, then whatever intention I actually form is going to leave open some leeway for me to do otherwise, you know, in the counterfactual circumstance. And the same is true for actual character. And there's this big debate about theories of divine providence, the Molinism view, the view that goes back to the 16th century Spanish Jesuit, Luis de Molina. He thinks that there's tons of these true counterfactuals. So there's a lively debate even now still going on about this. Okay, I won't say anything more about that. So there's reason to think that maybe there aren't any true counterfactuals for this view to get off the ground with respect to. But suppose that there were, and there was an infinite number of them, then it looks like we're praiseworthy and blameworthy for way more than we've ever imagined. On the sensible assumption that my praiseworthiness doesn't cancel out my blameworthiness, it looks like I'm both infinitely praiseworthy and infinitely blameworthy. And that seems, well, it's certainly revisionary, but it's revisionary in a way that strikes me as implausible. Okay. Right. So this is the versions of libertarianism that get going because people think that they've got to factor out all the luck. But some versions of libertarianism are motivated in a different way. They think that there's a good reason to say that luck and causal determination, or being causally determined by factors outside of your control, does undermine free will. But the usual benign examples of constitutive luck and circumstantial luck don't. And there's different versions of how this could go, but I'll just briefly say that if you think that in order to act freely, you've got to have alternative possibilities at the moment of choice, where these are full-blooded alternatives, where the causal pathways are really open to you and open to you given who you are, then we can see why causal determinism rules that out, right? Because there's not two paths open, but just one. Okay, so that's our rationale for why causal luck or luck in causal determination undermines free will, but it doesn't apply to constitutive luck and circumstantial luck, because these kinds of luck can influence what options are available to us without collapsing them into a single option. And so on this second version of general version, I should say the second family of libertarian accounts, they think that constitutive luck, yeah, that really is pernicious. That's bad. But circumstantial and constitutive luck, not so bad, at least in general.
Well, thanks so much, Bob, for talking through free will and moral luck and all these different positions in the free will debate. This has been a lot of fun. Where can listeners who are interested in following your work go to find what you're working on next?
You can go to my website, robertjhartman.com.
Awesome.
Cool.
Well, thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure to talk philosophy with you both.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah. And we'll put your website in the show notes so people can go and check that out.
Yeah, for sure.
Perfect.
In the next episode, we talk with Daniel Miller about the epistemic condition on moral responsibility and about cases in which an agent's moral responsibility for an outcome traces back to earlier items the agent's responsible for.